My name is Carlos Patron. I'm with EPA's Superfund program here in Washington, D.C., and you're all joining us for the U.S. and EU perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. This is the second part of a first seminar that we first held last year. You'll hear more about that in a few minutes. A couple of housekeeping items. Please remember to, if you are on the, you are on the phone line, to keep your phones on mute to keep the noise down. And also do not place us on hold if you need to take another call. Quite often, companies have streaming music while we're on hold, and that would come across to the entire line. So please don't put us on hold, but do put the phones on mute. I'd ask that everybody go to the first page of the seminar. So at the registration page, when you first log in, you'll see an overview description of what the seminar is going to be, who the presenters are. On most of our names, you can click on it, and you will get a little short bio. And at the bottom, there's a button to go to the seminar. I ask that you please go there. And you will see the first slide has my name on it, so you'll know you're in the right place. If you have a slide with the title of this of the seminar, and my name, Carlos Patron. While I get started, let me mention a couple of things. We are certainly glad to host this seminar, as we did the previous one last year. I should point out that while we're happy to be able to provide this platform to exchange ideas and points of view, we do not necessarily endorse positions, products, or services that are discussed on this seminar. Also wanted to mention that this is part two of this CONSOL seminar on U.S. and EU perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. You'll hear a bit more of the background of what was discussed earlier from Speaker Dietmar Mueller in a few minutes. And I also wanted to mention that we hope that this will not be the last one. We expect to have subsequent seminars, the first of which will cover the Americas, the whole hemisphere, North and South America. We're gearing to schedule that one in collaboration with some partners in Mexico and elsewhere. That will be announced when it's scheduled on Cluen. And later on, we hope to have another one with Asia. And again, Mr. Mueller will discuss those in more detail. So again, everybody should see beyond slide number one. It's the welcome slide to the Cluen Internet Seminar. We wanted to mention the navigation. For those of you who have not been on these seminars before, you will be using the navigation buttons at the top of the screen. When we call the next slide, please click on the forwards button. At any point, if you have a question, you may click the question mark button. That will send a question via chat, which I will be able to read. I may take these questions at the end of each speaker, or I may hold them for the discussion part, depending on whether they're specific technical clarification or they are a greater discussion point. Okay, so again, remember, you have the navigation buttons at the top. Those will be there permanently. And you have the question mark button to submit a question or comment at any point in the seminar. Okay, let's go to slide number two, please. Oh, here's a housekeeping slide. I just went over this on the front one, but again, remember to press star 6 to mute and pound 6 to unmute your phones, especially if you're on a cell phone or if you don't have the mute button on the phone itself. Please do hit star 6 to mute. I just heard some keyboard tapping, so somebody there is not on mute. So everybody please check that you are on mute, and that's star 6 to mute and pound 6 to unmute. Thank you. Let me ask quickly. I've asked Carolyn to check with Bonnie Arthur. Do you know if she's been able to join us yet?
No, I haven't gotten a hold of her. Bonnie, have you clicked in?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning.
And Paul Bardos?
Yes.
Oh, is that you, Paul?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, good morning, Paul.
Good morning,
Paul. So, let's go straight to slide number 3, please. Okay, slide number 4, because I just covered slide number 3, was kind of repeated. Slide number 4 is today's agenda. Again, I'm the moderator, and I'll be giving a few introductory comments. I'm Carlos Pachon with US EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. We are principally a tech transfer office of the Superfund program. When the Superfund program was created, CERCLA, the law that created the program, also included a clause there. Since back then, we knew very little about cleaning up contaminated sites, that the program would have a tech acquisition and transfer function. We're still in that function, advancing best practices in the cleanup of contaminated sites, which is basically what we're talking about today from our point of view, green remediation. Today we have a few speakers that I'll introduce briefly. The first one after I speak, Mr. Dietmar Mueller, from the Environment Agency in Austria. He will be speaking to us from Vienna. And he's going to give us a recap and summary of findings of concepts and initiatives that were discussed in a previous internet seminar and presented at CONSOL in Austria. Mr. Dietmar is currently the Deputy Head of Contaminated Sites Department, and we've been collaborating closely on this and previous seminars. And it's good to have you with us today, Dietmar. The second speaker is Bonnie Arthur. She'll be presenting a U.S. case study on green remediation. Bonnie is a remedial project manager with U.S. EPA Region 9, the Superfund program in Region 9. She's calling in from San Francisco, so it's an early call for you. Appreciate your joining us, Bonnie. The project she's talking about is a very interesting project. There have been quite a few best practices that have been adopted related to green remediation and other. So thank you, Bonnie. The third speaker is Mr. Mark Van Bemmel, who is with BioClear in the Netherlands. I was fortunate to hear some of his presentations at the CONSOL conference late in October of last year. And he'll be presenting two case studies from the Netherlands. So welcome, Mark. I did notice in the last batch of slides, Mark, you've added a few. I just request that you try to keep to the time slot we had discussed earlier. Following Mark, we have Paul Bardos, who's calling in from the UK. Mr. Mark Bardos is Dr. Bardos is the managing director of R-Cube Environmental Technology, and we have also been working closely with him on this and previous seminars. And he will be presenting some discussion topics, which will then lead to the discussion which I will be moderating. So that's the agenda for today. We have saved a good chunk of time for discussion. So. If you have questions for any of the speakers throughout the seminar, please feel free to ask them. I will be pausing periodically for the phone lines, and remember that if you are on streaming audio, you can ask them at any time. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. That would be, I believe it's slide, I'm sorry, I can't see the number on my screen, slide 5. So this is the title of the slide is Developments. It's the United States perspective, and this is a very brief summary. If you need more background, I welcome you to go to the previous internet seminar where we discussed a lot of these topics in more detail. But I wanted to give you, for those of you who are new, and for those of you who have heard of this before, just a quick recap of where we are. Here in the United States, as far as the EPA, we started off with a technical primer on green remediation in 2008. And that was intended to lay out what types of opportunities there are in implementing a site cleanup project to reduce their environmental footprint. That was a very successful product. It's still out there. In fact, you'll probably still see it on, you can still download it from our Green Mediation webpage. But it's been followed by a lot of other products intended to share the knowledge that is being generated not only internally, but amongst other parties that implement remediation in the United States and elsewhere. In addition to the work that we got started, there were several groups, including private corporations and others, that joined in the Sustainable Remediation Forum U.S., and they released a white paper on sustainable remediation in 2009. So in parallel to the work that we were doing, there was a lot of work also in consulting and responsible parties and others that involved in the cleaned up contaminated sites to identify positions and definitions and best practices in this area. EPA continued to work internally on the management of its sites and released Superfund Green Remediation Strategy in summer of 2009. Now, this is specific to the Superfund program. Remember that in the United States, there are five major cleanup programs, either by regulatory framework or by the source of the funding, depending on how you look at it. And this one was specific to the Superfund program. The strategy was later updated in a year later, in fall of 2000, in late summer, I'm sorry, of 2010. And I'll give you the resources to that soon, but basically lays out how the Superfund program, in managing the cleanup of its sites, will seek opportunities to reduce the footprint of that work. Equally important was a 2009 policy on green remediation titled Principles for Greener Cleanups that was released by EPA's Assistant Administrator for the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, basically the EPA land office, quote-unquote, the office responsible for management of cleanup programs. That policy is common to all cleanup programs and lays out some basic principles, some which I'll touch on in just a second. Finally, there's in some initial ASTM work, can somebody help me with ASTM? It's escaping me right now.
Testing materials.
Thank you. So that work started on development of green cleanup standards in 2010. That work continues. What we're looking for is working with them and lots of other parties that are involved in defining some common language, common understanding, common goals of what we're trying to achieve. If you go to ASTM.org, you can read about this standard. Also, learn how to, you can become involved if you are interested. Before I go on and hand it over to Dietmar, I did want to mention a couple of key U.S. EPA perspectives on the topic that we are discussing today. This is a bit of a recap. The first is this concept that greener cleanups are not an alternative approach to setting cleanup levels or selecting remedies. But that's why it's important to have this dialogue so we'll have an opportunity to understand where different parties are coming from. And this is an important point for the agency, especially in the Superfund program. We're not looking at greener cleanups as an alternative approach to setting cleanup standards or selecting remedies. Also want to point out that cleanup sites for reuse, we believe, It's clearly linked to sustainable development. One of EPA's great contributions to environmentally and economically sustainable communities is the history we have of working closely with many parties to clean up contaminated sites and prepare them for productive reuse. These sites are often already have an infrastructure to support them and are in developed areas with good connections to other neighborhoods and the rest of the region they're in. So using these sites for new development not only provides an incentive to clean them up and remove a public health hazard, but it also accommodates growth in already developed areas, which relieves pressure to build on economically valuable farmland and ecologically valuable open space. And often, too, contaminated sites are neighborhoods that really need the new amenities, the homes, and the jobs that redevelopment can bring. But furthermore, here in EPA, we're looking hard to reduce the environmental footprint of the work needed to clean up those sites. So while implementing remedies that are protective to human health and the environment, greener cleanups help us be protective and sustainable. And so that's the set, you know, expansion on that second bullet, and on that third bullet, also almost in a sense reiterates the first one, that reducing the environmental footprint of a cleanup does not justify the endpoint. In other words, to make it simple, putting a fence around the site does not equate to extracting, destroying, or destroying the contaminant. Okay, so if we could please go to slide number six. So what is R, the definition that EPA is using for green remediation? It's the practice of considering all environmental effects of remedy implementation, incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprint of cleanup actions. So with that, we'll go to slide number seven. This is it for me. I did want to highlight that URL, fluent.org/green remediation. We've had that URL since 2008. It's a very densely packed site, hopefully easy to navigate, with a lot of information, including best management practice, fact sheets for by technology or by core element of green remediation. For example, what are green remediation practices for soil vapor extraction? It also has policy references, such as links to the EPA principles for greener cleanups. It's got technical bulletins. We have 30 case studies, profiles of projects where green remediation best practices have been implemented. Links to training information provided by us or by others, and also internet resources beyond EPA. Again, that URL is cluin.org/green remediation. So again, just a reminder before I hand it over to Dietmar Mueller from Austria EPA. If you have any questions throughout the seminars, you can ask them with the question mark button. And at the end of Mr. Dietmar's presentation, I'll take the first phone line questions. Otherwise, you can feel free to hold on to them. We do hope to have a good conversation and discussion at the end of Paul Bartus's talk. So with that, I'll hand it over to Dietmar. Dietmar, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Carlos. Thanks for introducing me. My name is Dietmar Müller. This is Vienna speaking. So if you move on to slide 8, my talk will be on giving you a brief summary on concepts, initiatives, and information exchange we managed so far. So we organized it together with the US EPA and SURF UK. And moving on to slide number 9, you see the outline for my talk. So I just brief want to introduce the story, what was before CONSOIL last year, then to provide a more general perspective to the terms green and sustainable, going for a brief highlighting the policies, the comparison between the US and within the European Union, finally introducing the initiatives which joined in so far. So we are talking about governmental organizations as well as non-governmental organizations. And finally, providing information and ideas how we want to organize further information exchange and discussions. And move on to slide number 10. So briefly on the international fora, how they grew during the last years. So it was obviously the Sustainable Remediation Forum in the US 5 years ago, more or less, followed up by European initiatives. So there is SURF UK. So there is a chapter, the first chapter for SURF in Europe, as well as NICOLE, which raised a working group on sustainable remediation by 2008. The first exchange and discussion happened at the Green Remediation Conference in Copenhagen, which was held in 2009 ahead of the UN summit on climate change. And there the idea was born to have webinars and to have a follow-up also for COMSOIL. So the first webinar, the first part of exchange was last July, and we raised a paper summarizing the international developments. You will find it also on the resources list. And finally, we had two special sessions at COMSOIL in Austria last September. One session, again, discussing international developments. The second session, going for case studies to make it more tangible. Moving on to slide number 11. It's simply what already Carlos introduced, the definition of green mediation provided by the US EPA. If we put it more general, it's about green practices, and green practices which need to be conducted in ways which minimize environmental burdens imposed by any or by an activity. So what is important maybe to keep in mind is that we have to face, there will be always environmental burdens. We leave an environmental footprint, but what we can aim at is to minimize it. In comparison, moving on to slide 12, to discuss, in contrary, what's about sustainability and sustainable development. So obvious, it was started, the idea, by the Brundtland Report in 1978. The development that meets needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. You see the three circles, figuring out the three dimensions which should be covered within sustainable development. It's about the social dimension, an environmental dimension, and an economic dimension. And coming together, that's what within the white paper we raised was the description for sustainable remediation to look out for a broader concept of balancing economic growth, protection of the environment, and social responsibility toward the achievement of an improved quality of life for current and future generations. Again, it is important to keep in mind that there is no sustainability as a peak, but in comparison to act more sustainable about the time, to look for a sustainable development of our societies, to balance the three dimensions, social, ecological, and economically. Moving on to slide 13. So what we found, green and sustainable remediation aim in common, or what's the common framing or kind of a common denominator, is that we are trying to change our thoughts, change our mindsets, but not only mindsets, that's the prerequisite to have different practices in the future. What's also in common is that green and sustainable, per idea, they look for integration to the decision-making process and the design of remedies, as well as the implementation itself and operational strategies aside. As I mentioned, it's about understanding impact in a comparative way. So comparing will always depend on the framing and the values we as humans, as society, are setting. Again, values for the three dimensions on sustainability. But also in common is about, well, we're looking out for transparency in decision processes and for involving local communities and other stakeholders. So it's about looking for a fair solution, satisfying anyone involved. Fair and better solutions. So moving on to slide 14, the next slides are simply to highlight how the policy frames are changing or have been changing during the last years. You see, simply for the U.S., you have already heard the introduction by Carlos. So that's simply some statements at any political level you may find. So it starts up for the principles of for greener cleanups, but you will also find really high-level statements like the citation of President Obama that, well, looking out for federal agencies in the U.S. taking the leadership in environmental energy and economic performance. Moving on to slide 15, walking a bit north at the continent, it's about Environment Canada initiative also joining in, not present today at the roundtable, but still they will follow up. So to briefly introduce the policy frameworks there, well, there is the Federal Contaminated Sites Action Plan, which already was set out 5 or 6 years ago. In 2006, there was a new institution built up, so it's called the Treasury Board Policy on the Management of Real Properties. So since 5 years, they're looking for new policies to manage the land sustainable and financially responsible, looking for life cycles and getting it efficient and cost-effective within government programs. And just the last year, last October, they set out for a federal sustainable development strategy for Canada, which will change again the framing for remedies, which will trigger down and affecting how the remedies will be done. Moving on to slide 16. It's one slide on Europe. Europe is more various. There is a European level within the European Union, and there are national levels. At the European level, there is, I mentioned within the slide, 4 policies. So it's the soil strategy, which, talking about contaminated sites, will be a future or maybe a future core. But there are further policies like the 6th Environment Action Program and the ETAP, as well as the Strategy on Sustainable Use as well, and that might be the interesting one, discussing also sustainability, the European Climate and Energy Targets, the 2020 targets, looking out for until 2020 to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 20% in comparison to the emissions in 1990, to look out for having by 2020 20% of energy from renewable resources, and finally to reduce the primary energy use by 20% by means of improving the energy efficiency. So you may remember a lot of things which are similar to U.S. thinking. As an example, for a national level, you may look at Austrian. So here in Austria, our government raised its sustainability strategy in 2002. 3 years later, came down with environmental quality objectives, which are means to control and measure the progress towards sustainability. And just 2 years ago, as a reaction to the governmental programs, we defined 6 key objectives to contaminated land management, where one key objective is looking out for sustainability. Moving on to slide 17, to now away from policies, I will not leave too much time for the U.S., simply as Carlos already introduced you, and finally, also, you will find it in the resources. Also, just highlighting maybe the principles for greener cleanups, which cover 5 core elements, which will be introduced by Paul Bardos later on. Moving on to slide number 18. So there is brief information for the Sustainable Remediation Forum in the U.S., which still has several ongoing technical initiatives, like, for example, well, of course, looking for framing the whole thing of sustainable remediation, but also more to making it more tangible, practical, fostering for remediation criteria and metrics, and having a focus on life cycle assessment. And finally also, you see again the sustainable remediation white paper, which was launched in 2009. Moving on to slide number 19. So we are moving to Europe, starting by the first European chapter, which was SURF UK. SURF UK, funded in 2007, a collaboration of different sectors, so you find regulators, industry consultants in there. They are doing their open forum meetings. They are coordinated by a non-profit organization, CARE, which is independent and serves the platform itself. And you see what they came down with so far. So there is one report you may find on the framework for sustainability within the SURF UK framework. Again, you find these two major phases where sustainability should be implemented. So it's about the project design in the left half of the bottom picture, and about the implementation at the right half of the bottom picture. Finally, they also already delivered a review, so it's the second document you see, a review on published sustainability indicator sets, and that material will be also indicated on the resources. Moving on to slide number 20. So it's the second European SURF. It is a working group within NICOL. NICOL is looking out for having a guidance document, which consists of a roadmap, which is already available. It's a very brief, very condensed four-page booklet, which was launched by the end of last year, and which links up to a full document. So the full document is still work in progress, but I guess it will be ready in most parts before summer. And it will work out on economics, so provide a checklist of tools and guidances and references, as well as looking for the indicators and the risk correlation to risk assessment, providing also some illustrations with case studies. Still, there are ideas on pilot testing. Moving on to slide number 21. The Common Forum on Contaminated Land in the European Union. It's more or less kind of the twin to NICOL, whereas NICOL is an industrially led network. The Common Forum is more a regulators network. It exists since 1994 and simply aiming also for, well, new concepts for an efficient policy based on risk management and sustainable remediation. What is important to look for it at national and European level. So these are really the European member states meeting up, exchanging ideas and developing a new agenda. So the Common Forum is about to, one of the big actions was the Clarinet within 2002 already published its first ideas, and the risk-based land management concept for Europe. Within this, they identified as major trends to policy development in Europe that site remediation will be driven by two priorities. Priorities based on the need to reuse land. So there is simply in a lot of parts of Europe, a big social and economic need to redevelop our sites. And the second driver, simply the environmental province, so present risk to solve them. Those two priorities to foster the weight towards the sustainable development of contaminated sites. Moving on to slide 22, just briefly introducing two further European initiatives, which are Eurodemo Plus and Colony. Eurodemo Plus, which has been a project funded by the European Commission as well, like Colony. Eurodemo Plus keep providing a focus for technologies and the demonstration of innovative technologies and different to green or sustainable or something in between. It's with a focus to eco-efficiency, so simply the ratio of two dimensions which are covered by sustainability. Cabernet, which is a network which aims to enhance or to react on the first driver mentioned with regard to Carinet, so rehabilitation of brownfield sites within the context of sustainable development. So it's Paul Nathaniel who is expected to be to the round table discussion with who will present Carinet. Moving on to slide 23. So it's not only the U.S. initiatives or the European initiatives. There are new chapters growing. So at Consoil last year, we had the first discussions with Surf Australia, and within the upcoming web seminars before summer, so the Europe-Asia seminar, we will involve with Surf Australia. There's also growing Surf Brazil, and what could also be of interest, the International Standardization Organization with the Technical Committee 190, which is called Soil Quality, by last October also decided to introduce a new work item which is on sustainability and sustainable remediation. Moving on to slide 24, coming near the end. So green and sustainable remediation, as we discussed at CONSOL last year, what are the ambitions? Ambitions we clearly faced since a long time. Well, there is a primary goal to protect human health and the environment. But besides and moreover, we need more action lines or more basics. It's about optimizing benefits at any of the dimensions you can see. So it's about economically, site remediation, which will work and work out for increasing property values, creating jobs, or so on. Also, simply in terms of ecology and social affairs, improving the general quality of life and healthier communities. On the other hand, it's about minimizing impacts. What's the interesting and difficult thing discussing sustainability, that there are different levels you can look at, so it's maybe local, that's obvious. You might link up with regional and global thinking, and crossing the scales, that's the interesting and challenging discussion. Minimizing impacts, of course, obvious, that's at the first line for environmental footprints, but there might be as well much broader thinking, like for if we discuss rehabilitation of sites, it's simply about using, well, we have sites where infrastructures exist. If we are able to reintroduce them to economic cycles, that's something which can introduce what we call smart growth. Moving on to slide 25. Still open questions. We only started to debate is, of course, it's about the whole framing and about values we set. So it's about how to integrate and balance different impacts to understand our comparisons. So it's integrating the three dimensions, which are defined where we start off from our societal framing and values, still keeping in mind that values we have nowadays may change over time. So some 10 years ago, greenhouse gas emissions haven't been any topic in a public discussion or for too much for site remediation. As nowadays, the remediation sector, as any other sector, is asked to, also introduce and think about which contribution in saving greenhouse gas emissions is possible. What is also an important issue is, besides the three dimensions as written, time is an important driver or might be considered as a fourth dimension to sustainability, and changes over time are rather important. Like mentioned before, crossing the scales from local to global, it's about, we have different scales we consider. So that's poses the questions of system boundaries, when we design or when we implement a remedy. So different scales, so we're working at sites, we're working within a specific regional setting. We have, a national frame, and we try to act globally responsible. And there are interactions and trade-offs, how to consider them. It goes along, again, with system boundaries, trade-offs, interactions in between different regions. So jobs created in one region may simply be a problem to other regions. There may be also interactions and trade-offs in time. So that's about what the Brundtland report just addresses, or what could put it in a perspective of fairness in between generations. Moving on to slide 26. So that's what, together with US EPA and SURF UK, we try to organize is information exchange and discussion. We are aiming to sustain a meeting place of ideas as a follow-up to the Green Remediation Conference as well as to CONSOL last year. So that's the idea for the web seminars during 2011, and the web seminars simply also as a means of reducing our environmental footprint, not traveling, but exchanging ideas that way. Still, finally, face-to-face meetings and discussions would be preferable sometimes, so we are also discussing to have a next Green Remediation Conference by 2012. Moving on to slide 27, which provides simply lines we discussed for future actions or future webinars. So probably we don't need too much more discussions on the international or the national framings. Conceptual frameworks might be a topic as well, like practical tools and metrics, or how to practice synergies. I guess the case studies, which we'll provide in some minutes, give a first taste of it. And, moving to my last slide. That's my finish. So green and sustainable remediation. So we need to work at the site scale to make it work, to make a better solution. Still, in the framing, we're working within regions. So what we need to understand is as well as our natural and the social system. And, as we're discussing sustainability, of course, and globalization, that's the whole globe we're acting on, and we have to act on practice, common responsibility. So thanks for listening. That's the end of my talk. Carlos.
Thank you very much, Dietmar. Appreciate your words. Also want to recognize your leadership in this area for getting us together for Console, the actual live track that was held at Console. And you reminded me also of Klaus Weber, who got us together in Copenhagen back in 2009. That was really helped get this conversation going. So thank you very much for that. I do want to remind everybody that if you have questions, you can ask them at any time by clicking on the question mark. These can be clarifications, an expansion on a point or that was made, or opening up a topic for discussion. I have a couple of that I want to, well, at least one clarification here from Richard Lord in Teesside University in the UK. He was asking, what is OSWRD? I noticed it's an acronym in one of the slides. And again, that's EPA's Office for Solid Waste and Emergency Response. It's basically the Land and Materials Office here in the US EPA. Wanted to ask if there are any questions on the phone lines for Dietmar's presentation. Again, a clarification, an expansion, or discussion, which we may ask that that we take it later in the call. Okay, well, I do have a couple of questions here. They're more discussion related, a couple from Paul and Nathaniel. And Paul, I appreciate that. If it's okay with you, I'm going to hold these questions for the discussion part. With that, I think I'll go ahead and hand it over to Bonnie Arthur. Bonnie, who will be presenting a case study from the Pacific coast of the United States, Frontier Fertilizer. Bonnie Arthur, with Remedial Project Manager with EPA's Region 9. Bonnie?
Thank you, Carlos. Good day, everybody. I'm happy to present the Frontier Fertilizer as a case study today. I have a wonderful team that has worked very hard over the last 8 years to incorporate sustainability into many of our activities at the site. At the same time, keeping on target for our very important cleanup goals. Today I'm going to give you a brief overview of the site, let you know what type of chemicals that we have there and why we're required to clean it up. I'm also going to talk about our groundwater treatment plant and the energy efficiency measures we've been able to incorporate there. Next up, I will talk about our two solar installations. We now have the solar capacity to completely offset the energy of our groundwater treatment plant. Next up, I'll talk about our more recent activity, which is to reuse our treated groundwater for irrigation. And last up, I'll talk about our thermal treatment that just started last month out at Frontier Fertilizer to clean up the source area. As I said, I have a great team made up of members from the state of California, community members, and of course EPA's contractors, which implement all of the work that we have designed and set up. I have a great contractor that was willing to prioritize the extra measures that we took, as well as get all of the cleanup done on time. We've also had a very active community group that has participated in the process for the past 15 years. Some of the same members are still with us today, and they review all of our documents. They comment on them. They tell us what they think we're doing wrong. We've had to definitely make some changes as a result of their participation. Slide number 31. I'm going to at least give you the big picture of where Frontier Fertilizer is located in Davis, California. Davis, California is in Northern California on the western coast of the United States. California is a large agricultural state, which is why we're there cleaning it up as a result of some of the agricultural practices, and I'll get into that in another slide or two. The primary crops that we have in this part of California are fruit trees, tomatoes, almonds, rice. As you know, there's quite a few vineyards, but they're more to the west. A little bit too hot in the summer in Davis for the vineyards. One note that I wanted to make, because it comes into play later with our solar, is that We have at least 78% of sunshine days, and all that means is that those are days where there is 30% cloud cover or less. Slide number 32. You can see on this slide a picture of the triangular parcel that we're cleaning up today. It's a different site for EPA in that it's very small. The actual area that we're actively cleaning up is only 8 acres. As in our country, as in many of yours, very many of our hazardous waste sites are hundreds or thousands of acres large. So this site is unique in that it's very small. However, we know from our investigations that the quantity of pesticides and soil fumigants was so large to create this problem that we're left with. There was no manufacturing that took place at this facility. It was just pesticide handling and mixing. They would bring the powder onto the site, mix it there, bring it out to the neighboring farms, to the fruit trees and other crops. And then when they would come back to the facility, from what we can tell from historical records, although there aren't that many of those, as on many sites, they would dump the remainder in an unlined disposal basin on the northwestern portion of the site. So EPA became involved in this site in 1994 when we listed it on our national priorities list that is commonly known as Superfund list. And most of the activities out here took place in the 70s and into the early 80s. Now, the other reason, other than the fact that there's large amounts of chemicals that were disposed of in the northwestern portion, the other reason why we're actively involved in the cleanup here is the toxicity of the compounds that were disposed of, in particular dibromochloropropane and ethylene dibromide. These chemicals have been transported down through the soils and groundwater to 115 feet below ground surface. Slide number 33, and then you can see a site map. And focused on the triangular parcel, you'll see that as I move through my slideshow. That, again, is where most of the activities took place. We're located along a major interstate, goes from San Francisco up to Lake Tahoe, right to the south, and there's a neighborhood right 600 feet to the north, is a residential area. The fact that we have a major interstate right to the south deterred us from being able to put in a solar concentrator or wind turbines, but that was a few years back. You can see the dotted lines. Hopefully they show up well on your screen, and they indicate our target cleanup zone for the groundwater contamination. As you can see, we have contamination at least 800 feet north of the triangular parcel underneath the homes. Luckily, this contamination is only low levels of carbon tetrachloride. The groundwater treatment plant that I'll talk about in just a moment has been able to contain the plume of the highly toxic pesticides to keep that south of the neighborhood. We've been actively running a groundwater treatment plant since the mid-1990s to control this plume. Slide number 34 is a brief overview and a picture of our groundwater treatment plant. This is a very standard extraction and treatment facility, such as, you know, EPA has thousands of these across the United States, and I'm sure many of you have them in your countries also. I'll briefly explain what we're doing here. We have 16 extraction wells located 400, 500 feet to the north. These pump the water out of the ground and pipe it back to these large blue vessels. These blue vessels are full of activated carbon. They're basically like a large Brita filter, like what you may use it in your home. The chemicals are run through these blue vessels, and they are absorbed onto the carbon. We change out that carbon regularly. then we're able to discharge this water with non-detectable levels of our chemicals of concern to the current approach is to the local city sewer. This system, as I said, has worked great to contain the plume. As you can see on my slide, we have treated, as of December of last year, 1,500 pounds of these chemicals of concern. Been very effective. However, it hasn't been able to be the final cleanup, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Next slide, number 35. Some of the measures we've been taking in the last 7 years are to decrease the energy usage of the plant. Since you have to run these plants 24 hours a day for many, many years, and this one in particular has been running for 15 years, it's quite costly. The yearly electricity bill was up around $26,000 a year. Actually, that's a moderate energy bill for these plants. Many have much greater energy costs than that. Some of the measures that we did was to take out a 10-horsepower pump that was actually pumping the treated water to the sewer. And in 2004, we were able to replace that with a gravity flow pipe. And that made a huge difference. It cost $20,000. However, we were able to reduce our annual electricity bill by $7,000 by just replacing this one pump. Another measure we took, which has really helped the efficiency of the plant and thus helped save energy, was installing variable frequency drives in all 16 of our extraction wells, and we did that in 2006. So that really cuts the amount of, that gives us the longer life for each one of those pumps. So we did all of these tasks just under our contract task of maintenance and upgrade. Slide number 36. So in the midst of all of our cleanup work, my former project manager he has an engineering degree with a background in renewables. He kept saying, Bonnie, we got to do some solar. So we were one of the few government contracts, so we've been under budget a few times, and we've been able to incorporate adding renewables because we've had these budget opportunities. See, so the government sometimes actually is under budget. The first rooftop solar system we put in 2007 was very small. It was only a 5.7 kilowatt direct current system. And in the summertime, I actually was able to meet about 15% of our energy needs. It was installed by a local small business, and as you can see, very nice view from the rooftop, but up 20 feet from our treatment plant, above our treatment plant. Slide number 37 gives you a few more specifications about this initial PV system, photovoltaic system. Capital cost was $35,000, and that was after we got a state of California rebate of approximately $12,000. So by incorporating and adding this solar, we were able to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 4 metric tons per year. Now, as I said, we were lucky. We had some extra funds when we were getting ready to do a contract transition, and we took the opportunity to add this first solar. Slide number 38. We had always intended to add to that small system. We've been keeping close records of our annual energy usage, and when we had some additional funds available on a contract that was ending, we were able to buy our large system. This is a 68 kilowatt direct current system, and with the two systems combined, we're now able to meet the energy needs year-round of our plant. The footprint of these panels is a half of an acre. So, you know, we still had room in our little 18-acre site to add on this solar. These panels were manufactured in Massachusetts, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. Slide number 39 gives you some more specifications regarding this system. Capital cost, was $350,000, and the state rebate, state of California rebate, is $100,000, and that's paid out monthly. Our annual electricity bill at that time was $16,000 a year after we had put in the energy reducing measures back at the treatment plant. So that calculates to approximately a 14-year payoff for the both systems combined. This system alone reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 50 metric tons per year. Again, as I said, these funds were available because we were under budget when we were closing out another task order. Some of the challenges that we faced with this particular system was that the monies used were from the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Many of you know that as the stimulus, at least folks from the United States. When you are spending stimulus money, you have special monthly reporting. There was additional sheets of, you know, how many jobs we were creating any given month that we were in these stimulus monies. Another important factor with the spending this type of money was material sourcing. It had to be manufactured in America. So actually, as many of you know, there aren't that many solar panel manufacturers in America. So we did find one in Massachusetts that we purchased this from. Slide number 40. One of our more recent measures, and it's not underway yet, but we hope to get it underway this summer, is to have a higher beneficial use of our treated groundwater. As I said in an earlier slide, we are able to treat this water down to non-detectable levels of our chemicals of concern, and we wanted to find a better use for that water rather than just sending it to the city sewer. So we formed a team with myself and our state partners, as well as my contractors, and we put together a report that identified, you know, what have our chemical concentrations been in the history of the treatment plant. And we also looked at salts and total dissolved solids, because that's very important when you go out and talk to somebody about reusing your water as to what the salt levels had, especially for us. They were about 1,400 milligrams per liter. And so, you know, it's not going to work to irrigate certain crops or certain landscape plants with that salt content. We are lucky in Davis because they have many parks and green belts, so there are lots of options for reuse right located near our project. So what we did, you can see in slide number 41, we developed a map where it's color-coded in terms of what the different entities were and are, and what land might be available for reuse. So as you can see, the triangular parcel again is in yellow on my slide, and that's our Frontier Fertilizer site. So we looked at all the areas around that to see a possible reuse. So to the north, you can see quite a bit of blue, and that's parks and green belt. And then over to the east, you can still see there are some agricultural fields up in the top right of your slide. So that's a possibility too. As you all know, agricultural fields require quite a bit of water, and that's all. They rely on well water at this time for all of this irrigation of this area. So we would love to be able to offset some of that pumping from the wells with some of our treated groundwater. One other thing I wanted to highlight is that the green over to your right of the bottom right of your slide is the interstate. And so we've been in talks with the state of California that manages that because they have some irrigated areas there also. And one thing that obviously we took into account was, you know, we wanted to be able to pipe to a shorter, you know, pipe a shorter distance and a shorter distance away. And so, you know, that would reduce our capital cost. Slide number 42, let's talk briefly about this. We have been in meetings for the last couple years with the city of Davis, and it's been, you know, quite a few of their departments that need to be involved in this. And so it's Parks and Recreation, Public Works, and even the city manager's office. Unfortunately, in the last year, the city of Davis, like many of our communities across the country, have hit severe budget shortfalls. So this is kind of we've hit a hurdle with us moving forward with them. So right now we're looking at other entities as well as private parties. But we think the city will hook into our piping once we have it up and running. But some of the challenges and things I wanted to point out is that when you're developing these kinds of systems, you have to make it easy to use far into the future. EPA will not be involved in this site after 2020. And we have to make this easy for the city to use and easy for the state to use when they take over. Slide number 43. This is our most recent cleanup action, and it came about when we were developing our long-term cleanup plan a few years back. We're required in the Superfund program to develop all the possible alternatives for cleanup, and then you evaluate them against 9 criteria, including, of course, how effective is this cleanup process going to work with your particular site contaminants and your particular site characteristics. But it also includes state and community acceptance as well as cost. So with our particular contaminants, we didn't have many options. We really only had excavation, which was prohibitively expensive, because the toxicity of our compounds, you would have to tent the whole excavated area to protect the nearby community as well as the workers. So when my team proposed alternatives, one of the leading alternatives was thermal treatment, and we just kind of went, no, we don't like this use of electricity. You know, how could that work out to be a good alternative for us? Because here we were trying to save energy in all these other ways, but we were looking at this alternative that was a large energy usage for a short time. So we did go through the selection of this remedy based on the fact that with doing this short-term effort, that you would be able to drop off the running of the groundwater treatment plant from hundreds of years to just decades. So when you look at that comparison, you know, it finally made sense. You know, that's like, okay, I can get behind this. So, you know, we were pumping the groundwater for 15 years, and you know, we still just weren't getting at the source area. And the source area, all that means is where, you know, historically the chemicals were disposed of onto the ground. And so that's where you have your highest mass of chemicals bound up in the soils and in the groundwater. And the groundwater pump and treat system just wasn't getting to that. And we still just had too much bound up between 30 to 90 feet below ground surface. And like I said, with this 9 criteria that we're required to use by law in our Superfund cleanups, it's very important that the state and community, what their interest is. And in this case, with the community so close to this site, they wanted it actively cleaned up. They didn't want to have to worry about whether that groundwater plume was going to migrate further to the north and underneath their homes. Slide number 44. Just going to give you a very brief overview of how this technology works. It's called electrical resistive heating. You can kind of see in the middle of the picture, there's 3 rods. Those are electrodes. We've installed 236 of those at this site. 111 of them are deep, meaning they're going from 40 to 90 feet below ground surface. And the other half are very shallow, just to about 7 feet below ground surface. So what you do is you pass the electrical current through these electrodes, you set them up in an array of 3, and the soil itself provides the resistance, which increases your temperature. So in this case, the design is to treat this contaminated groundwater and soil to the boiling point of water, or 100 degrees centigrade. And then what you do is you collect the vapors and the liquids in separate treatment streams, and then they both go through carbon and before they to clean them up. And then at this point, the design is supposed to, we're supposed to end up with non-detectable levels of these chemicals of concern at our stack. And then they're sampling all along this path, at least on a weekly basis, to make sure that you're meeting those goals. The whole system is kept under vacuum, and there's a 5-layer cap that overlays the heating area. So again, it's a very high short-term use of electricity, but allows us to shut down the treatment plant so much earlier that as a whole, you are reducing the environmental footprint by doing this cleanup. The actual energy usage is 2.5 megawatt when we're at the peak of the cleanup program. Slide number 45. Now, one of the things that we looked at was a partnership with nearby businesses or the city of Davis to be able to bring in a very, very large solar system, a 1-megawatt system, which would be a 5-acre system, so that we would be able to use it for our thermal treatment for a year and a half, and then they would take it over. And we're very close to making that happen. We were all really excited about it. We worked with the city for almost a year, and we even had members of the congressman's office and the mayor's office participating with us in those meetings. And like I said, we were very, very close, but then because of the legal complications with the land ownership, as I said, this was not a viable responsible party, so that's why EPA has been running this site for the last 15 years. But it did make it difficult for them to take over the solar after we were done. I also looked at trying to bring the solar concentrator in, as I said before, but when I talked to the developer in New Jersey, he said, now where are you located? And I said, well, you know, right to the north of Interstate 80. He said, oh, no, you couldn't do that. You would blind everybody with the solar concentrator. Well, finally, slide number 46, I wanted to just say briefly that some of the lessons we've learned is that if the teams develop a to-do list all throughout the cleanup with, you know, what can we do to make this cleanup more sustainable and keep that as a priority while juggling all of the cleanup deadlines that we all have, you know, it's helpful. So then when you have these little, you know, budget surpluses, which we were really lucky because that happened twice with us, you know, you can do something with those. But obviously, I think more of these projects need to budget for the renewable energy so that they can get incorporated into these cleanups because it really can work and be effective. The other big message that I wanted to say is to reach out to your local city or your villages and your businesses to share some of this renewable energy, like for a project like ours, or to reuse the treated groundwater, and those can all be options. So thanks for listening, and if you have any other questions at a further later time, you can feel free to email me.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. That was a great presentation. Appreciate it. I'm going to take a couple of questions on the internet. We are a couple of minutes behind, so we'll try to select some shorter ones. Here's one from Ann Thompson of Public Works in Halifax, Canada. Her question is, I would expect that reuse of highly contaminated water, even after treatment, would have raised local area concerns, especially with the preponderance of well usage in the area. How is that dealt with?
Yeah, that's a great question. We put this proposal out for public review. We sent out a fact sheet to see what folks would think about it. And it was surprising. We only got two comments back. I think they kind of wondered about what concentration levels was one of the questions and how we were going to distribute the water. But as I said, you know, we've been real lucky. We've had this community group working with us for 15 years. And so we were able to go to them and to propose it to them first so we could get, you know, some feedback and so we could kind of be a little bit proactive about what kind of community concerns there might be.
Great, thank you. Anna Thompson also asked a question about the website for Eurodemo. I'll take the opportunity to mention that resources, links to web pages, resources, publications, et cetera, that are discussed in all the presentations are available at the end in the resources page. You'll see that there's a link there to additional resources, and we link directly to all the resources listed or mentioned today. So please go there for that. And finally, a question here, which I guess you addressed, from Paul Nathaniel. He said, Bonnie's presentation is a great demonstration of green remediation, i.e., given that we will pump and treat, how can we do so for the minimal environmental impact? However, why was pump and treat chosen over, say, an in-situ strategy, such as PRV that may be more sustainable? Now, since you addressed it, I presume, through the in-situ thermal remedy that was selected to address the source areas. I wonder if you want to say anything else about that.
No, that's correct. The pump and treat was just an interim measure, kind of like it was started as a removal action by our emergency response group. So then that led to 9 years, as many of you know, they can go on and on, before we got to the remedy selection for looking at the comprehensive cleanup of the site.
Okay, and a final one before we move on to the next speaker is a question that comes up quite often. How is the carbon disposed of, and I would say we're managed? We have found in doing footprint analyses that granular activated carbon itself can have a significant greenhouse gas footprint.
Yes.
So the question is...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Carlos.
The question is, how is the granular activated carbon managed?
Okay, well, I wish you'd asked us that last year. Up until last year, it was all regenerated. And then we ran into problems with some of the regeneration facilities not being willing to take DBCP, I believe is what it was, the dibromochloropropane, restricted us from being able to regenerate. So actually, we're looking now at some other innovative technologies to be able to treat the carbon on site. But for the last, I believe, 6 to 9 months, we have had to send it to a landfill. So that is definitely a negative to us after being able to regenerate it for 14 years.
Thank you. Good clarification. I appreciate that. I'd like to move on. We have quite a few additional questions. If you can hang in there, Bonnie, and time permitting in the discussion area, we'll ask them. Some are specific to the remedy, but most of them do have a broader theme with respect to green remediation and or sustainability. But in order to get through all our speakers and have time for questions, I'd like to go ahead and hand this off to Mark Van Bemmel. Mark, have you been able to join us again?
Yes, thank you, Carlos.
Go ahead, please get started.
Okay, well, first, I would like to welcome everybody. Good morning for everybody in the United States, and good afternoon to everybody in Europe. Let's move to slide 47. That's the title of my presentation. I will present two green cases from the Netherlands, and let's move on to slide 48. First, I would like to... This is the Brundtland definition about sustainability, which has also been presented by Dietmar before. It is the sustainable development is the development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And that is the broader definition that we use for sustainability. Let's go to slide 49. In my opinion, in remediation projects, this means that we will strive for a low energy use, low CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. We want to use renewable resources. We want to reuse materials. And what is also of big importance is that the hindrance and social acceptance must be good. So minimal hindrance and maximal social acceptance. And a final one is that the remedy of the remediation should not be worse than the disease of the contamination itself. That is just a rule of thumb that we can use to select green remediation alternatives. Let's move to slide 50. Okay, I will present two examples of green remediation. The first one is solar-powered soil remediation in Ameland, and this is more or less comparable to the site that has been presented by Bonnie just before, so I think I will go over that a bit quick, so we have a bit more time for the next one. This is the sustainability of a full-scale bio-augmentation project in The Hague, the Netherlands. And I will finish my presentation with some conclusions. Let's go to 51. Okay, case one is located in Ameland, which is an island in the north of the country. It's about 20 kilometers long and about 5 kilometers wide, and it is about 5 kilometers from the mainland. It's a former oil production site of NAM, which is a Dutch oil company, and it is contaminated by mineral oil and BTEX. It is in an isolated and vulnerable location situation, situated between the nature and almost immediately on the beach. You can see it on the photograph on the right. You can see the square patch located in the dunes. That is where the site is located. Go to slide 52. Well, the goal of our remedy was to protect the environment and to remediate this contamination, and especially to protect local drinkwater source, which is present downstream. We had some special site conditions in this case, which are quite rare in the Netherlands, by the way. We had to develop an independent remediation system because there's no power or clean water available in short distance. So this was a major, how would you say, a problem for us to overcome. It was very important to have a minimal noise and visual disturbance in this natural area, and it was also important that the site access is very limited. It's only by car over the beach. Go to slide 53. Okay, we have considered a few possible remediation strategies before selecting the solar remediation. We have considered natural attenuation, we have considered air injection, a biosparging system, and we have considered a pump and treat system to contain the contamination and clean it. Let's go for slide 54. Finally, the pump and treat system, which was solar powered, was chosen because of the low energy demands and because of the rather low permeability of the soil on this site. We did not need a large flow of water to be able to spread to keep the contamination from spreading. So we could design a rather small pump and treat system which is based on two pumps and six solar pumps. Okay, we have an active phase of about 5 years. Let's go to slide 55. This system was already implemented in 2005 and has been running from that time. You can see from the results that the influent concentrations of the carbon filter are diminishing over time, and the carbon filters are treating with a very high treatment efficiency. So it's comparable to what Bonnie has presented before, which we have excellent treatment results on that. And we can see that the groundwater concentrations near the extraction wells are decreasing. Still, we are able to contain the plume, but we are not able to remediate this site completely with this system. So it is a containment which is solar powered. And maybe it's interesting to note that also the maintenance is very limited. We go there only once a month approximately to check on everything, and it is so only also the man hours are really low on this case. Okay, well, I would like to move on to the second case, which is different from the cases that were presented by Bonnie on solar-powered remediation. The case number two is located in The Hague, which is the residence of the Netherlands, and you can see on the photograph it is a nice surrounding, which is architecturally interesting. It was made in around 1922 in the Cubist movement, and you can clearly see it from the buildings, and these buildings are quite vulnerable to settling, and this was one of the main problems that we had to deal with. Let's go to slide 57. Okay, I'm missing one of my, how would you say, Okay. One figure is missing from this slide. I'm excuses from me about this. I have no idea why. But we have. Let's move on to slide 58. I can explain you what the TCE concept of bio-augmentation concept is. From slide 58. You can see on the left hand, you can see about 16 infiltration wells, which are located around the groundwater plume, which is in the middle, and there are 5 extraction wells on the central axis of the plume. This is a laundry site, and it has been contaminated with tetra and trichloroethylene. It's about 80,000 cubic meters of soil above the Dutch intervention value, and the concentrations go up to about 1,000 micrograms per liter. And the plume is present until about 10 meters below surface level. The bio-augmentation concept is done in this way. The water is extracted from the 5 central extraction wells, and then it is led to above-site bioreactor system, which is an anaerobic bioreactor system in which dehalococcoides bacteria are grown in elevated densities, and then the water is re-infiltrated into the 16 infiltration wells, which are located on the edges of the plume. Also, beside the dehalococcoides, which is grown inside this above-ground anaerobic bioreactor system, we add a mixture of lactate and acetate as a carbon source. So when the water is infiltrated, it travels from the infiltration wells to the extraction wells. And you can see on the left side of this slide the lowering of the water table in centimeters. And you can see that the water table is lowered approximately 30 to 35 centimeters near the extraction wells. And once we have a complete flush through of the plume, then we cut off the system, and the system is removed from the site. And this site is located in a densely populated area, and we have a medium grain sand. As I told you, we have 5 extraction wells and 16 infiltration wells. We did a test on the hydraulic conductivity, which is around 12 meters per day. We have chosen a closed water balance, so there's no water left over. All the water that is extracted is re-infiltrated again. And the water table change is less than 42 centimeters, which was the criterion we had to work with. And the total flow is 10 cubic meters per hour. Now we can go to the next slide. The remediation took place from December 2007 to September 2008, and this was the active phase of 9 months of pumping and injecting the dehalococcoides culture. And in the passive phase, we had to reach the remediation goal, which is the Dutch half of the Dutch intervention value. And I have stated the concentration levels there, the most important being for DCE 10 micrograms per liter and for phenyl chloride 2.5 micrograms per liter. So in about 9 months plus 2 years, we had to reach these goals. Let's move on to slide 60. Okay, these are the results, which are also missing. I have no idea why, but this figure is missing also.
My regrets. I'm seeing we received the file correctly, but it did not load correctly, so I'm sorry about that.
Oh, it's no problem. On the rest of my presentation, some of the slides will be intact. We'll see about that. I can tell you what the results are. We can move on to 61. After 1 year, 6 out of 9 wells within the contaminated area were below remediation targets, and after 2 years that was 8 out of 9 wells. And in September last year we had a site closure. We reached all the remediation targets in all the wells. And with this, we have a complete in situ treatment of the TCE plume within 3 years at a total cost of €441,000. Okay, let's move on to the next slide to look at the sustainability parameters. Okay, well, we were interested to know how sustainable this remediation has been, and we have made a sustainability comparison to get an idea of that. So we have compared this bioremediation option with two alternatives, which are conventional pump and treat, and ISCO using ozone. Just to make the comparison, remedies for this. Let's move on to three. This is alternative. This is a conventional pump and treat system with 17 infiltration wells and 13 extraction wells and 10 cubic meters per hour. It's important to note that the water had to be re-infiltrated on this site because of the criteria for the water level. Also a closed water balance and a stripping system of 8 kilowatts. And we estimated the duration of 10 years and the cost at 900,000. Let's go to the next slide, slide 64. There we have alternative 2, which is ozone, an ozone sparging system analogous to air sparging. Well, we took a natural oxygen demand of 15 grams per cubic meter and a sparging efficiency of 5, then you need about 24,000 kilograms of ozone and a system of about 12 kilowatts. With a duration of 1 year, this would have costed around 800,000. So the cost of these alternatives are above the actual cost of the remediation that was performed with the bioaugmentation TCE concept system. Let's go to slide 65. We have chosen a method for comparison, which is a multi-criteria analysis, and here you can see all the parameters that we have selected for the comparison, which are the social effects, like smell, noise, hindrance, and so on, and the environmental effects. You can see the parameters there, the resources and the materials, and the climate effects. So our goal was to compare the remediation options on these four main themes, including all the sub-themes which are posted on this slide. Let's move on to the next, slide 66. Here you can see the scoring of the social effects in this graph. I'm glad this graph is is depicted correctly, at least on my screen. So you can see that the biological method, which is in the middle, has the best overall score for this comparison, for this MCA study of 7.1, and you can see that on the alternatives, especially the long-term hindrance of the pump and treat system within the city was scored lowly, and you can see that for the ozone on the right hand of the graph, you can see that the use of the dangerous chemicals and the chance of calamities has led to a lower score for the ozone. Okay, let's move to slide 67. Here you can see the environmental effects, and then you can see that there's not much of a difference between these three options. So I will just leave it to that and move to slide 68. And here are some of the resources, I think, which are important. So for the pump and treat system, on the left hand, you can see the energy demand of 700,000 kilowatts. There you can see the actual energy that we used for the TCE concept, the biological system, which was 63,000 kilowatts in total. And then you can see the expected energy consumption of an ozone system for this site of 600,000 kilowatts. And there you can see that the bio-augmentation method is about one-tenth of the energy consumption of the alternatives. Then moving on to below in this table, you can see that the chemicals which are used for the TCE concept are, of course, important. We have used 24,000 kilograms of lactic acid and 32,000 of sodium acetate. So these are important to take into notice for the sustainability assessment. Let's go to the next slide, slide 69. Here are some of the lactic acid life cycle aspects. The lactic acid is made from corn, which is grown on the land. The corn is made into dextrose, and from the dextrose, the lactic acid is made by biological fermentation. Once the lactic acid is used on the site, it will be transformed into mainly methane. And finally, when the methane would enter the atmosphere again, it would be transformed biologically to CO2. So this is what we have calculated for this site. You can see the production of the lactic acid is renewable and CO2 neutral, which is of course an important factor. And the same goes for the acetate, which is also made in a comparable way by biological fermentation. So you can use, for the bio-augmentation, you can use renewable and CO2 neutral carbon sources, which we think is a very important asset for this technology. You can go to slide 70. Okay, summing up a few important parameters for these three technologies. We have for the pump and treat, as I told you, the energy demands. We calculated the CO2 total for all the three alternatives, and there you can see that the biological method also has a lower greenhouse gas emission in total if you take all the effects into to your comparison, to your calculations. And you can see below the TCE concept, you can see from the 135,000 kilograms of CO2 that is produced, about 27% only comes from electricity, and the rest comes from the carbon source, which are transformed into CO2 on the long term. Okay, let's move on to slide 71. Here's a summary of our complete multi-criteria analysis. So I'm not showing all the sub-levels, but only the four major themes: the social effects, the environmental effects, the resources, and the climate. We all give them a weight factor of 1 just for this presentation. And there you can see that on most teams the biological system is better or comparatively the same. In total, you can see that the bio-augmentation scores better on sustainability effects. Okay, let's go to slide 72, which are my conclusions. We believe that green remediation is possible in many cases, as we have shown you on the island of Ameland. There are the options of solar powered low maintenance system. I believe, secondly, that MCA methods can help in selecting sustainable remediation methods. And thirdly, bio-augmentation is, in this case at least, a highly sustainable solution with a low energy consumption, a low CO2 production, and low costs also, and it is a very effective method. And I think I will leave it to this, Carlos.
Mark, thank you very much. I appreciate your getting through the slides, and sorry about those little technical problems. I did get a note from Dominique that she's not going to be able to stay till the end of the presentation. Dominique, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still there, sorry. But I need to leave to go to Brussels for a sole framework directive discussion tomorrow, so.
Great. Then then if you don't mind, I do have one question from you here. This is from, excuse me a second here if I can find it. Just refreshed on me just when I was going to ask it. What is this? This is from Michael Mueller at Aventis in Austria. What is the status of the Soil Framework Directive, EU policy, to complement the Groundwater Framework Directive? I know it seems like a long answer, but I was wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, so I will try to answer rapidly. The Soil Framework Directive is officially pending, okay? There is no proposal for the EU presidency that's currently angry for continuing to discuss on the Soil Framework Directive. But as Dietmar mentioned, because we have the soil strategy, there are other pillars of the policy where we have now soil provision. That's, for example, the Industrial Emission Directive or the Environmental Liability Directive and so on. If we want to avoid new soil provision in all our European directives, we need to have a soil framework directive. So currently, and that's the unofficial discussion, we are coming from, and some of our colleagues, like the Belgium, Finland, France, UK, Poland, Austria, I think I'm missing someone, but we are currently working on the new proposal of the Soil Framework Directive and trying to be as close as possible to the current experience in the in those countries and to have some sustainability included in the Soil Framework Directive. But that's an unofficial proposal. We will need to discuss this in Nottingham during our next Common Forum meeting. That will be in April. And then during this meeting, we will have a discussion with a representative of the European Commission. If we succeed to convince our other colleagues of Common Forum and the Commissions that this document, this new document, is the only one that is sustainable for this directive, we will ask the Hungarians and then the Polish EU presidency to take this document and make it as an official proposal from the EU presidency. That's the legal procedure. I do hope we will succeed. If not, we will have some difficulties because we will have some new soil provision in the other directives. And that's for us a problem because it's inconsistent between the different areas of the policy. I do hope I have answered sufficiently. If not, Michael, please send me an email, and then I will answer for email to those who are interested.
Thank you, Dominique. And, of course, through all the different networks that you have here, including fluent.org/consoil, we do hope and expect to be tracking those developments in future seminars as well as, you know, other forms of getting out to these audiences. So, thank you, Dominique, and safe travels.
Yes, sorry, but I'm going to discuss the Soil Framework Directive, so I need to be there tomorrow for sure. So have a nice end of webinar, and see you later.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
I do have one question for Mark, although it comes back to the United States. So I was wondering if maybe Bonnie can help us clarify this or any other EPA project managers that are online. And the question is, this is from Heather Smith, also from the Army Corps of Engineers in Vicksburg, Mississippi. If I understand correctly, the bioaugmentation involved reintroducing the pumped water back into the aquifer. This wouldn't be allowed in the U.S. until the water is completely clean. Is that correct? So maybe, I guess, first Mark, is that understanding correct, that the water is extracted, additive is inserted and it's reinjected? And second part, Bonnie or anybody else, would that be allowed in the United States?
My reaction is yes, that is correct. So the water is led through the above-ground bioreactor system where the Alcoholis grows on the contamination, but it is not remediated completely. The water is still contaminated when it is re-injected. But of course we make the geohydrological design in such a way that we do not get an unwanted spreading of the contaminants. So it's right that this is allowed in the Dutch situation.
Bonnie or anybody else, closed-loop systems in the United States?
Yes, it is. It is allowed. However, you cannot inject it into an aquifer zone different than the one you extracted it from. So we are considering that, but with the thermal treatment running out at Frontier, we're a little bit limited as to where we could re-inject the treated groundwater.
Great. Well, thank you. And with that, I appreciate your presentation, Mark, and thanks for addressing that, Bonnie. But I'd like to move on to Paul Bardos. We're running, as you can tell, very short on time. I think we had quite an ambitious schedule. So, Paul, I hand it over to you, and then see how much time we have for discussion.
Thank you very much, Carlos. I hope everyone can hear me loud and clear. My first slide is slide 73, and my job is to try and be lightly controversial to try and stimulate some discussion, but it would appear that there's plenty of questions already. So I'm going to recap on the things that we've been through this morning or this afternoon, depending on where you are. I'm on slide 74 now. So three things in this brief set of slides. Review of definitions, some analysis, if you like, of how and why green and sustainable remediation are different, and then I'm going to hand it over to you with a slide with a few questions. So, next slide, slide 75. Well, green remediation is a term that has been specifically defined by the US EPA. Whereas sustainable remediation is a term that's been described and defined by various initiatives. Now, both terms also have a colloquial use, which I'll come back to, which can be confusing. Next slide, 76. Well, you've seen this before, but basically I just want to reinforce the definition of sustainability, that there are three elements in sustainability, an environmental element, a social element, and an economic element. On top of this, there are notions of what are called weak and strong sustainability. In weak sustainability, you might trade some environmental degradation for a very large social and economic benefit, for example. In strong sustainability, there'd be some environmental criteria or limits which you cannot cross. So moving on to the next slide, slide 77, green remediation is defined on the basis of five premises, really. The first is to manage and minimize the use of resources and the generation of waste, moving clockwise. The second is to reduce energy use to improve energy efficiency. In particular, there's an interest in using renewable energy. Next one is protecting the quality of air in terms of reducing fugitive emissions, but also greenhouse gases. Protection of water. And finally, conserving, protecting, and restoring land and ecosystems. Two important features of green remediation are that firstly, green remediation integrates practices that are either environmentally beneficial or neutral into the design, selection, implementation, and operational strategies of a site cleanup. Secondly, and very importantly, is its requirement for transparency for the local community and other stakeholders, as we've already discussed. Sustainable remediation is a slightly broader concept. It grew out of, in Europe at least, this concept of risk-based land management, which Dietmar has already mentioned. So the driver for remediation is always the management of risk. If there were no risks, you wouldn't be doing the remediation. But again, moving clockwise around this diagram, it's important that the decisions that are made for this risk management are transparent and they're participatory, so that if the decisions you're making are affecting other stakeholders, those stakeholders have an opportunity to take part in the decisions. The important asset is that the outcome is balanced, so that there's a balance of benefits rather than the remediation and the risk management itself being outweighed by its wider impacts. That comes to the fourth point, of course, this idea of acceptable wider impacts. Now, this is in common with green remediation, except that in the case of sustainable remediation, we're looking at a holistic range of environmental, economic, and social factors. And for an example of that, an example of the indicators of that, you can go to the resources, which Carlos has already mentioned, and download the draft indicator set from Surf UK. Moving on to the next slide, which is 80. So a typical definition for sustainable remediation, this is a UK definition, the practice of demonstrating in terms of environmental, economic, and social indicators that the benefit of undertaking remediation is greater than its impact, and that the optimum solution is selected through the use of a balanced decision-making process. And we can sum that up very shortly, as Mark did. We don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. There's a link there where you can download this definition and other information from Surf UK. Now, there are a number of other networks which have made similar descriptions of sustainable remediation. And while these might be slightly different, I think something that's very important to note is that they're not substantively different. Moving on to the next slide, which is 81. So looking at what green remediation and sustainable remediation have in common, well, there are two things really. Clearly, they have in common a wider environmental perspective than solely meeting risk management objectives. And they also have in common this idea of transparent decision-making and a wider engagement in decision-making. Moving on to the next slide, 82. But there are some differences. There are differences in the range of environmental criteria that these different initiatives consider. A fundamental difference is that green remediation isn't really focused on social and economic criteria, whereas sustainable remediation is. Another fundamental difference is the decision-making boundary. So green remediation is strictly focused on the remediation process, the remedy, whereas sustainable remediation also looks at the wider project. So it sees remediation as a component of a wider set of land management decisions. Moving on to the next slide, which is 83. Can't count my own slides. Why are they different? Well, there's a fundamental reason why they're different, which is that there are organizational differences, constraints, and responsibilities. So the US EPA has a particular mandate, and to some extent that mandate determines how it approaches the wider impact of remediation. And more generally, across different countries, there are differences in contaminated land policy and regulation, and these are to some extent reflected in differences in how green and sustainable remediation are defined. However, I think there's a market pull towards sustainable remediation, and I expect we will hear more about this from the different SURF initiatives later on in the discussion. So my last slide, which is slide 84, my penultimate slide. Coming back to this question of confusions, one of the problems we have with terms is while we have defined green remediation, and while there are different sustainable remediation definitions, they're often used colloquially to mean the same thing. So green remediation, the Green Remediation Conference, for example, in Copenhagen that Dietmar mentioned, was actually a sustainable remediation conference in my language. And on the other hand, people might use the word sustainable remediation when they're meaning green remediation. So the use of language is confused. And furthermore, as I mentioned, although sustainable remediation is generally defined in a similar way, not everyone's version of it is exactly the same. There might be differences in the scope, in the way the boundaries are set, in the approach to sustainability appraisal, and in the criteria that might be considered. So, finally, five questions really to kick off a bit of a discussion. Would you agree with this brief analysis? And then, getting a little bit more controversial, do you think it's a problem to have both green and sustainable remediation concepts, or can they coexist? If they're coexisting, might it be necessary for some projects to use a decision-making framework that's green remediation-based at the same time as one that is sustainable remediation-based? Is this helpful in some jurisdictions, or is it a nuisance? I think something that we think about in SURF UK is that we think that green remediation is a subset of sustainable remediation. I mean, would you agree? Is that a helpful kind of a consideration? And I guess most controversially of all, practically speaking, what is the real added value in decision making for including economic and social criteria compared with just looking at the wider environmental impacts alone? So with that comment, I'm going to hand back to Carlos, and hopefully I've inflamed a few passions that people want to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that, and appreciate those comments and those questions to open up the dialogue. As everybody's probably looking at their watch, we're really short. We're practically out of time. I'm going to propose here that for those of you who can, we take this to 12:10 Eastern, or 10 more minutes after our expected closing time, so we can at least address some of these questions. I'm sorry for those of you who can't make it, but I'm going to note that this will be archived audio, so you can come back and hear the discussion. We had initially hoped to have some of the speakers from previous seminars introduce themselves and their organizations, including Stephanie Fiorenza from SURF US, Olivier Moret from Nicole, Dominique, who I have to check out from the Common Forum, Nicola Harries from Claire, Paul Nathaniel from Clarinet, and Hans Lenders from SURF Netherlands. Unfortunately, given the time constraints, we're going to have to ask that you keep it to just answering some of the questions. And maybe I'd ask, given the questions that Paul just laid out, if you'd like to address any one of those particularly, and then we'll take some of the questions from the seminar. So I'll go ahead and start with Stephanie Fiorenza from SURF US. Stephanie, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Carlos, and thank you so much for this invitation. And in recognition of our short time, I would like to say on behalf of SURF, thank you for inviting us, and that we within SURF see a very clear and distinct difference between green and sustainable remediation. I would concur with Paul Bargos that green remediation could be considered a subset of sustainable remediation. We in SURF US support the holistic definition of incorporating sustainability principles, you know, into the practice of remediation at all stages of remediation, and would also see the value in going back to a land management decision. I think number five, the point about what is the practical added value of including social and economic criteria, is provocative and interesting, and I think I saw on one of Mark's earlier slides the suggestion of a pilot, and I would welcome the further discussion of a pilot to explore the benefits of comparison of green and sustainable remediation. And with that, thank you very much, Carlos, for your time, for the time.
Stephanie, thank you, and thank you for joining us. Olivier, is there a particular question you'd like to take on behalf of Nicole, or any comments you'd like to make?
Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. just on behalf of our working group, the nickel working group, I mean, I must say that, you know, everything that Paul described here is totally in line with our conclusions. So, you know, we are in agreement with what Paul described, with what Stephanie just said. We are launching pilot testing of, you know, the roadmap that we developed last September on sustainable remediation, and we hope to get some better understanding of what would be the impact of including those economic and social criteria in, you know, analyzing the project. So that's, I think that's about it for the moment.
Okay,
unless there are some questions.
We're going to try to go through this, the folks that we did specifically invite, and then we'll come back to some more general questions. But we know that Olivier is on the line, and he'll be able to take questions as well. Nicola, are you with us? I heard you sign in earlier. Nicola Harris from Clear, UK. Just checking that you're not on mute, Nicola. Okay, I guess she has to leave us more or less on time. So, Paul Nathaniel from Clarinet. Okay, I'm not here. I do have a couple of questions. This is on the...
Carlos, it's Paul Vardis here. Paul Vardis here. I've just got an email from Paul Nathaniel to say he can't dial in.
Okay. Let me take one of the questions he did lay out earlier. Let's see. Carlos has superbly clarified, thank you, Paul, the difference between green and sustainable remediation. Green is how you do the remediation. Sustainable is choosing what remediation to do. Can Carlos confirm his understanding of this? I guess maybe I'll get to that in my comment. That's more something specific to me. I don't know if there's anything on Paul Nathaniel's blog that you can bring up, Paul Bardos, with respect to Clarinet. While you do look at that, I understand you're looking at it live. Let me go ahead and ask Mr. Slenders, Hans Slenders from SURF Netherlands, if there's any particular question of the ones that Paul raised that you'd like to take or any comments, observations you'd like to make. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Can you understand me?
Yes, perfectly.
Thank you, Carlos. Okay, thank you. Well, the questions are, just as Olivier and Maurice said, are in line with what we think in the Netherlands. But especially the fifth question, what in a practical sense is the added value of the other aspects? Because we are convinced that the other aspects are crucial for calling something sustainable. But does it really have an added value when you have to work with sustainable remediation in a practical sense? So I would be wondering how that about the outcomes of a certain pilot, how that would come out. And the other question, Chavel, the difference between green and sustainable, that's clear, and we all agree, I guess, what the difference is. Okay?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Hans. Thank you very much. Paul, were you able to weave out any statements from Paul Nathaniel with respect to Clarinet, or...
I think Paul is representing Cabernet, actually.
I'm sorry about that.
One thing that Paul mentioned on his email list right at the very beginning was that he found the initial presentations from you and from Dietmar very helpful in showing how sustainable remediation and green remediation are different. We then had a discussion, and he agrees, along with Dominique, Olivier, Hans, and Stephanie, who all took part on that email discussion, that, if you like, sustainable remediation is covering the project and the remedy selection, and it's covering the three elements of sustainability, whereas in simple terms, green remediation appears to be focused on the remedy and on its wider environmental impact. That's kind of like a summary of this email list. I think the email list is open to anyone to join, and I've sent you the web link now so you can put it on the resources.
I will do that. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then I did get a note from Nicola Harris, and again, she looks to you, Paul. I guess you're the big networker in the EU. She states she's sorry she had to leave on time at 4 p.m. for another meeting. She wanted to know if Paul, maybe you could represent Surf UK's view on any of the questions that have been raised, if you'd like to do that.
Carlos, happy to. I'm working my staff six very hard here.
Okay.
I think in respect of the, in respect of all of the questions, I think that in Surf UK we recognize that there is a particular sensitivity about this in North America. And we also recognize the legal and organizational reasons why different approaches are being taken. I think that the analysis I presented is consistent with what my Surf UK colleagues would think. Nicola sent me her questions, answers, if you like, by email. We don't see any fundamental problem why you can't have green remediation and sustainable remediation coexisting. They're both useful concepts. I think that a problem might happen on some projects where you have some stakeholders who are demanding a green remediation decision-making approach, and at the same time other stakeholders are looking for a sustainable remediation context. But we don't see that arising in the UK, really. I think for us in Surf UK, it has been useful for us in publishing our framework to consider green remediation as a subset of sustainable remediation. It's helped us answer questions from many of the members in our open meetings. Why are there two different things? I think for the last question, I think that this really depends on the policy context of the country that you're in. In the UK now, we have a new government and they have this thing called localism, and I haven't really got a clue what it means. But it basically seems to mean decisions being brought to a more local level. And in that case, you're probably going to see more of an influence of economic and social criteria. But one thing that I would add, when we've defined our indicators in the UK, we see anything to do with people or humans as being a social in the social theme. So that includes management of risks, that includes health and safety issues for workers, that includes impact on road transport, that includes dust emissions and all sorts of things which are very important to people living around the project. I'll stop at that point.
Thank you, Paul. And per Paul Nathaniel's question earlier on, you know, is on that distinction between green and sustainable remediation, and the distinction that you made, I think there is quite a bit of agreement. We look at it as an incremental improvement to existing frameworks to select and implement cleanups. Those frameworks were designed, through a regulatory process, a political process, and do ultimately reflect social and economic priorities of at least the United States. And I suspect that if one started from scratch in developing a contaminated state policy from a sustainability perspective, but with seeking protection of human health and environment, which is ultimately why we have these regulations in place, I suspect that we wouldn't end up in a very different place. One question that is common is how to integrate and balance impacts. So that's something we haven't had a chance to discuss on this call. So if we have to choose between a greenhouse gas footprint and a, for example, a water resource footprint for the same end, how do we choose between them? And that's a very site-specific question, as you suggested. And I think one thing we really want to get out is first recognize that those footprints exist, and then identify options for reducing them. I guess like Peter Drucker said, if you can only manage what you measure. So at this point, we're basically raising awareness as to what those environmental footprints are and what the options are to manage them. But again, I would agree that ultimately green remediation helps us reach sustainability, which ultimately we achieve by cleaning up sites and getting them ready for reuse. But I think not all has been said, and it is 10 past when I'd ask for an extra 10 minutes for everybody. So there will be a follow-up seminar, a couple of follow-up internet seminars specific on this topic. Either any of the networks through which you found out that this one was taking place, we will seek to announce it. Also, one specific URL is cluin.org/consoil. That's another one where we will keep you abreast of what is happening here. So with that, I'm sorry to have to finish and that we're a little bit over, but I think this was a great discussion. Thanks, Dietmar, Bonnie, Mark, and Paul. And for those of you from the previous roundtables, appreciate your participation as well. And also recognize all those of you who signed on the Internet or on the phone lines for your time and interest. Bye-bye.